Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Welcome back.
It's good to be back.
You were English last week.
I know. It was a weird experience for me, too.
Do you listen to the...
I did listen to
the Missing Secret podcast where you're not...
I tried to. I feel like I've heard all the rest of them. Why should I skip those?
It gets you your encyclopedic knowledge of this podcast, which,
yes,
as we
I
know,
remember
nobody,
every single thing.
Yeah, nobody remembers more about the history, detailed history of podcasts than the person who is on the podcast.
That's right.
It's not true.
Yeah. I
love
remember
that.
Podcasts I've been on. I don't remember books I've written. I don't remember books I've read. I mean, what do I remember, I guess, is the real question.
That is a good question.
Less and less as time goes by.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of, a lot of episodes. I hear there's somebody, we just did the 10th anniversary of The Incomparable, and there was somebody who was like, yeah, I'm on my third listen through, and I just want to make it clear. It's 500 plus episodes of The Incomparable, and they've listened through all of them twice and are in the third pass through. And like, people make these calls about like I remember things from the past, but people are like, oh, you remember when you said this thing? I'm like, no,
nope,
I don't remember everything.
Not remotely. I mean, it's funny, too, because at the end of every year when we do our best of clip shows and people are always like, oh, what was your favorite moments from the show this year? I'm like, I honestly can't remember.
When we picked Skeletor, was that this year? No,
yeah.
That was like 8 years ago. Oh, well, then I don't know.
I don't know. I don't remember anything that I've said or done for the past year.
No idea. Absolutely no idea.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, you know. What you gonna do? Nothing much happened while you were gone. Just more yelling between Apple and Epic, basically.
Yep. Saw
it's
that.
A par for the course.
Saw
there.
That a little bit. They're I see that they're now, they've advanced this now to going back to the mudslinging in the press, where now Apple is promoting their rivals, the PUBG. And
sure.
Epic is talking about how it's Apple's fault that the new season of Fortnite is on Apple devices. And
of course.
Sure, I mean,
fair.
That's what you do. That's what you do.
Yeah,
you yell a lot
in the court
actually,
of public opinion.
I just tweeted about this a little bit ago, but it reminded me of this because it was kind of something similar, which was I was downloading an app to try and use, and I had to sign up for an account, and it had the sign in with Apple button, and I hit it.
This tweet made me laugh.
It was so annoying because it was like
sign in with Apple is easy.
Yeah, I was like, oh great. So I hit sign in with Apple, and then it's like, okay, it popped up the dialog. It's like, you got to link this with an account on our site, or if you don't have an account on our site, you got to create one. I was like,
no,
I think that's not how this is supposed to work at all. I think that is a violation of the way this is supposed to work.
Yeah, they should create the account. When you sign in with Apple, that's how that works.
Yeah. And so I was like, well, I guess I'm not using this app. So, I mean, you know, things that Apple, I feel like, you know, this is a case where they should be, maybe that's too strong. This is a case where they've established a rule and it seems like this violates that rule. And so it's possible that it's just such an obscure app that you know, nobody has thought to complain or realize that it's an issue.
Right.
But somebody in App Review probably should have caught that. So,
no kidding.
Who knows?
Well, I wrote some stuff this week. I don't think you've written anything this week. I'm checking now. This is your first appearance on Six Colors this week.
It's been quiet.
Oh, you posted some podcasts, I guess.
I did post some podcasts. I think that was pretty much it. It was, coming back from vacation is always a little bit of a struggle.
Yeah.
And like getting back into that groove.
No, I get it. I get it.
Yeah, I and also because it's Thursday, it's August.
It's Friday, Dan.
It's Thursday.
See?
The first week is always the toughest. They're like, other than this ongoing stuff, it has been fairly quiet. I expect that will change.
Yeah.
Although, again, with everything getting kind of knocked off kilter this year, we don't know exactly when that Apple will start doing its usual fall stuff.
Yeah, I don't really have any idea about that, and I'm kind of just letting myself not care about it because I feel like this year of all years, we really don't know what Apple's strategy is going to be, and I'm not going to waste time worrying about it.
Doesn't really matter.
I will say I'm not putting a lot of effort yet into... Well, that's not entirely true. So this was the week that I switched over to the betas.
Mm-hmm.
So my iPad, my primary iPad, is now on the beta. My phone is not yet, although that's probably going to happen pretty soon. And my Mac is now running Big Sur, my iMac Pro, which is scary, but it had to be done. And so I guess that's my way of emotionally preparing for, much later than I think I would normally do it, the idea that these things are going to come out and I'm going to need to write about them. I'm still sort of assuming that they're not really going to come out, like the Mac is really not going to come out for a while, and even the iPhone and iPad operating systems may not come out until later than usual. But I've also kind of taken it easier than in the past, just because I feel like, I don't know, some of it may be just 2020, but it's like, I'm not Federico Vittici, right? I'm not writing in a super intense thing about iOS that I need to have ready to go whenever it launches or soon thereafter. I'm not in that boat. I anticipate writing more about these operating systems when they come out and thereafter, but I'm I don't know. I feel a little less urgency about it this year for some reason.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is, and I don't want to demean anything, but it does seem like it's a year where there's bigger fish to fry. Like, this is important. Like, this is the stuff that we write about and people still care about it. But at the same time, with everything that has happened in 2020, it does sometimes feel like, I mean, it's your technology. It's important, but it's not that important. So trying to walk that line of like, yeah, we want to write about this and talk about this, but is there an urgency to it? No, there's not an urgency to it. Like, everybody's stuck at home. It's not like you're like, oh, I know, right? Do I have to upgrade before I travel or not? It's like, you're not going anywhere. I know you. And I already did the worst thing possible, which was I went to vacation for a week with a beta that was really unstable. And it was fine. It was fine.
It was fine.
There were some annoyances, but it was fine. Yeah. You know, so not the end of the world. And you know, frankly, the end of the world might happen in 2020. We don't know.
It would be fitting, really.
Yeah.
Seems so like the time. I did what I did do this week. Somebody wrote in about it. So on Monday I posted two posts to the website. One of them is 20 Max or 2020 about the PowerBook 500 and 5300, which happened around 1995, and a thing about the 25th anniversary of Windows 95, which was also 1995. And somebody said to me,
weirdly,
did you plan the juxtaposition of those two pieces? And I said, well, given that I wrote one today and the other in January, no, not planned at all. But there was just a shot of the mid-90s in there. And I think it's also it's whatever is in the eye of the beholder, because my Windows 95 thing, my point was really to tell an anecdote about the lawyers changing the cover of Mac User, and to say that in hindsight, although I was a junior editor at the time, I had no say in that story or anything about it, but it was the story that was like Windows 95, so what? That was the cover of Mac User, which I love from a spite perspective. Like, Macworld didn't even put it on the cover or mention it or anything, but Mac User went there, right? And they were like, so what? It's still not a Mac, I think is what the cover line said. And I wasn't really involved in it, but like, you know, that was an interesting time. And looking back on it 25 years later, my point of my article was like, it was enormous because it was a near fatal blow to the Mac, because it made PCs so much better than they were before that it blunted all sorts of arguments about, well, but I want to use a Mac because, even though I maintain and said, you know, Windows 95 wasn't better than the Mac, but certainly not easier to use, but it was so much closer than Windows 3.1, and it blunted a lot of these things. When in a moment where we're trying to save the Mac and say, like, please don't take my Mac away from me, or please don't make me use a PC, I need to use a Mac, this was very... It made that argument very difficult. And on top of it, it had some technical underpinnings that were superior to what the Mac was doing. And, you know, my point was basically to say, well, so what? It basically almost killed the Mac, and Apple was desperately casting around for an operating system upgrade to respond to it, and it took them years to get there, and they ended up having to buy Next in order to get there because all their internal stuff failed. So, like, it was I really viewed it as a, you know, we tried to shrug it off at the time, but it was actually enormous and had huge impact and almost killed Apple.
Yeah. Was it an existential threat? Really? Yeah. Honestly. Yeah. I mean, you know, I didn't.
So, of course, somebody responded to that saying, oh, you Mac users are the worst. And I'm like, I just said, and I think he was offended that I said that the Mac was better than Windows 95, which it totally was.
Yep.
But I'm being generous here. I'm being magnanimous by saying, yes, Windows 95 was very important and so important that it almost murdered Apple. Like, it was that serious. They're like, oh, you Mac users with your... It's like, well, goodbye to you, sir. And then I find it funny that Gruber's response was something like, Windows 95 even looked better than the Mac. I'm like, look better?
Yeah,
I wouldn't go that far. It certainly looked more modern than the Mac, because a thing that I've said in a few places is, like, even to this day, but certainly classic Mac OS, it's very clearly a black and white operating system with some color thrown on it later. And you look at Windows 95, it's like, oh, like, they went all in, it, like, it looks much more, and no matter what you think about that, better or worse, like, it's got shades of gray, and it's got beveled buttons, and it's got colorful backgrounds. It's like, everything about it is...
Colorful. Apple didn't really get there until what, like Mac OS 8 or something, that was actually felt more like color. 7 and 8 were the big one. The Platinum
and 8 helped, but I would say OS 10 is the operating system that was built with color in mind. Since it was not built in 1982 or whenever they were putting together the Mac interface before shipping it in 84. So I don't know. It's funny. It's in the eye of the beholder. My point was basically, oh, hey, that was 25 years ago. A bunch of people, Mac users, tried to shrug it off. It was very important. Windows 95 was very important.
It's definitely funny to think about the fact that, like, that seems like the jump, right? 25 years ago, and we were talking about classic Mac OS versus Windows 95. And it was really only a few years after that Mac OS X came around, which is something that seems still new, right? Like, and it's, you know, here we are almost 20 years after Mac OS X came out, and we've been using that now substantially longer than the classic Mac OS, right?
Because
if you go from 84 to 2000, and of course it continued after that for a little while,
but it was the primary OS for 16-ish years, and it's been 20 years since then.
We've Mac passed OS X.
Definitely, yeah.
I still think of it as the new kid on the block. I don't know. It's weird.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, it's newer than the old one, so I guess you know.
Yeah, I do remember. So I had friends who had Windows computers, but most of the time I spent with Windows was when I started working in my late teens, I want to say, at a university library where I did IT support. And at that point, I think when I started working, Windows 98 was the de facto, but there were some older machines still running 95. And so I spent a lot of time troubleshooting and updating those computers until I think we moved eventually to 2000, I want to say, Windows XP 2000 or whatever, or not XP 2000, Windows 2000,
right,
which was a pro-ish version.
Well, it wasn't Windows 2000, Windows, boy, we're in deep water.
NT.
That was Windows NT based, whereas Windows Millennium Edition,
which was trash fire.
Yes.
So I spent most of my time troubleshooting those things. So I'm much more familiar with them when things went wrong than, you know, using them every day and having things go right. And I spent a lot of time fighting with Windows 95 and 98.
Yeah.
But I knew all the ins and outs. I knew how you could, like, you know, fix things and where to go to troubleshoot certain problems and stuff like that. So for years, that was like all my exposure to Windows was through that, because I don't think I had a Windows machine myself. The only one I ever owned was one that I built, which was probably in college. So like in 2000 or something. That was a machine I had that ran out of a shoebox.
Do you know?
And it didn't have a power button. You had to turn it on with a screwdriver connecting two pins.
Do you know that Mac OS 10.0 Final, not the public beta, which was 2000, 10.0 Final came out the same time as Windows XP, 2001.
Yeah, it was March 24th, 2001. I kind of remember that
and
day.
And Windows XP stands for extra pickles, by the way. It's Windows with extra pickles. And what all those X product names in 2001, what's that about?
It was cool.
That is by far the version of Windows that I know the best.
Yes.
And to this day, when I use Windows 10, I get confused about what is happening, because I really just want it to be Windows XP, because I learned how to use that was the one that, like, if you had to emulate or eventually virtualize on the Mac, like, you just used XP. It was easy. It stuck around forever.
Exactly. It lasted for a long time. Almost everything was compatible with it for a long time because, you know, as we've talked about in the past, Windows' great virtue is that it tries to maintain as much backwards compatibility as possible. And so you could run XP first.
And they came out with Vista, and everybody's like,
Vista wasn't great. And then there was, 7, which also had some problems, and 8. And then we skipped over 9 and we got to 10. I barely scratched the surface of Windows 10, I have to be honest. Only used it on my wife's computer and stuff like that.
It looks nice. I still find it very confusing. And every now and then I get to a control panel where I'm like, this is Windows 95 here. What's
exactly
happening?
I always want to drill down into that part of it where it's like, use this wizard. I'm like, no. Don't use the wizard. Don't trust the wizard.
Don't trust the wizards.
And you got to dig really deep to find like that. Like, oh yeah, here's that old control panel driver interface or something.
Yeah, it's like on TiVo. On my TiVo, you can still find like the standard definition menus every so often. If you go deep down in, it's like, oh, this is the TiVo menu from 2001. Well, great, it's still here. Technical debt. But every now and then that happens on my Mac too, where I'm in a place like System Preferences is a good one, where there's things in System Preferences that are very macOS 10, 10.0
years,
and they're still there.
Yeah, well, I mean, Big Sur will be interesting to see because we've seen a lot of cases where in the beta, you know, they've used new UI that doesn't correctly accommodate stuff. Like, I like those when they got the new dialogue boxes and people are like, this isn't working, where it scrolls off the screen and you're like, should have looked at that.
Yeah, I actually just had that yesterday since I'm now using Big Sur on my regular Mac, which is a very different experience than using it on a test system, right? Because a test system's like, I'm going to go to Big Sur. And then you're in Big Sur for a while and you're like, goodbye, Big Sur, I'm out of here. And now it's like, oh no, I can't leave. I'm trapped in Big Sur. And I closed a window and the little like, oh, do you want to save this or discard it came up. And it was so subtle. And I thought, oh, that's not good. Like, that's not. You got to do better than this. It was way too small on my giant iMac screen and way too subtle for a moment where there's a modal saying, do you want to discard all the work you just did or save it? Like, snap to it. Come on. You gotta do better than that. So,
I still only got it on my MacBook Air, which I'm not using that much.
Yes,
but
you can see it in great, glorious non-Retina resolution, too.
As soon as there's a new laptop, I'm getting rid of that computer.
Well, so, I thought about running... So, with Big Sur, none of our friends over at Rogue Amoeba, none of the Rogue Amoeba audio software works. So, you may be asking yourself, Jason, how are you even recording this podcast?
Oh, you're going to be sorry you asked.
On Big Sur. And I thought for a long time that what I would do is I would take my old MacBook Air that's running Mojave or earlier, High Sierra, and I would just set it next to my computer and it would be my podcast interface. And I'd just use it like when I used to travel to New York for things, for upgrade. I would occasionally bring that mostly. I haven't traveled with a MacBook in a long time, but I'll use it for that as a, well, this is a complicated recording situation, the iPad can't do it, I'm not going to mess this up. And then I realized that I have my Mac Mini sitting here and it's not too far away. It's in the corner on a shelf, and I could use that because it's running Mojave. And so I bought on Monoprice, I bought a 15-foot long USB 3 extension cable. And I am speaking to you now from my Mac Mini, still attached to my USB interface, still attached to the microphone that's sitting at my desk. But the actual computer I'm recording on is like 5 feet away from me or something, which is weird. But that gets me out of the trap of having to reboot into an older operating system in order to do my job. So that's where I am right now, because Big Sur can't do it. Well, it's not that it can't do it. It's that Rogue Amoeba has to make some serious changes to their audio engine in order to work. And we rely on it. So here we are. I also, this week, the other thing I did is I did some user automation stuff. I did some scripting. I did some Apple script. I did some PHP with your help. And I did some JavaScript with the internet's help, and built 3 different versions of an air quality widget. And I wrote it all up. But that was kind of fun to do, and thank you for your help with that, because you had some good PHP knowledge that I didn't have. And the way I learn about this stuff is by seeing code in action. Like, I ended up building a widget using Scriptable in iOS 14, which is amazing. So Scriptable is this JavaScript engine app for iOS. And in iOS 14, there's a beta now in test flight. You can write widgets that just go on the home screen that run the code that's in JavaScript in Scriptable. It's amazing. And I adapted my script, your script, and this guy's script on the internet and put them all together and have a widget that does what I want that shows my local air quality. And the reason that I have my local air quality is because the big kind of like top level air quality stuff that's based on like National Weather Service or whatever is not granular enough for my area. Like, literally, I've got it where the next town up has clean air and we have smoky air, right, or vice versa. Right. And there's this network of personal air quality stations, essentially. And there's one nearby enough that I can use that and query that. And that was a fun little experiment, because I literally need to know when I can go outside and when I can't, when I can go for a run and when I can't, when we can open the windows and when we can't. Right now, because there are fires all around and there's a lot of smoke in the air. And rather than just kind of going to that web page every time, I wanted it to be a little more visible. So now I've got it in my menu bar on my Mac. I've got it on the little metric time clock that I've got in my living room. And I did a bunch of PHP shenanigans to display an icon when the air is bad. And also like reformat, because it takes up space. The icon does reformat like what gets the text that gets displayed there, so it's more compact when the icon is displayed. So there's a lot of like if then else kind of stuff going on. It was a lot of fun.
I used your that was an inspiration for me, because I like keeping track of the UV index, and so I found a API for that, which is fine. It's, again, it's probably not hyper local. I know you have that capability via
station. I could put that right in my menu bar from my weather station, but not everybody.
I can't. Unfortunately, I don't have a weather station. So, but I still found an open place that does UV via an API, and I made a little widget that does, you know, puts a little emoji next to it. Like, there's a little sun when it's high, and there's a little, you know, cloud with a sun behind it when it's kind of moderate. Aww. It's very cute. It's very cute. If it gets up to like 11 or higher, I think it turns into the sweating red-faced emoji. But fortunately, the only time I've ever seen that, I remember being in Florida a few years ago, and we looked at the UV, and it was 11, and it was purple instead of like red, and we're like, oh dear, that's not good.
The air quality is like that too. It goes because I had to look this up, because all of these things change, all my little scripts, they change the color based on the quality. So it goes from green to yellow to orange to red to purple to maroon. And maroon is hazardous, like leave the area kind of. Which is, it's interesting. So we've definitely had some purples here. But it's also, it's really great, because I can look and it says, oh, it's good. You can go for a run now. And so I can do that. Or I can, if it's stuffy, I can open up the windows and then I know when to close them. And in the living room, you know, there's no number displayed or anything. It's literally like if it's above yellow, it displays this kind of pulsating colored icon. Right. And that's good enough to be like, oh, you know, don't go outside or close the windows or whatever. And that's what I wanted, is I wanted a little ambient something. And I hadn't, all that Lemetric Time was showing was, time and temperature, but it has this icon capability and I just never bothered to use it. And so this was enough to kind of kick me over the edge there. And that's, there's a funny thing about all these, because I know you hit it with the UV too, is there are API limits. They don't want anybody who's got a web API for information like this. They don't want like a billion scripts hitting it a million times. I'm actually surprised that my air quality thing, I think that the people who provide that air quality map have not gotten sophisticated enough to build an API policy. They just seem to have a rate limit that is really generous, which is great. And I would pay for access to it, and I am buying my own sensor, which will give me unlimited access to it. But I have had to do, so like for my clock in the living room, the way that works is that clock reloads, it's loading a page on my web server, which is the same Mac Mini I'm using for this podcast. Every, I think it's 30 seconds. And so it's every 30 seconds hitting that thing. Now that page is displaying the time using PHP's time function. So it's whenever you load it, it's going to load the, doesn't matter when that page got built, because it's just going to show you the current time, which is good for a clock. I don't want it, because my weather station data only updates every like 5 minutes or something. And so I didn't want the clock updating every 5 minutes. That's dumb. The clock should update when the time changes. So every 30 seconds it refreshes. It shows the current time. It shows the current temperature, but current is being inserted every 5 minutes from the weather station. And then the, and then there's a separate script that runs every 10 minutes that queries the air quality and writes that to a file, which gets loaded in and evaluated. So it's a funny kind of situation where I've got the clock updating every minute, but a lot of the data in it is on it on all of the other data sources are on their own kind of refresh cycles. And that's mostly because I don't want to go out of control with querying all these APIs and stuff.
Right. We ran into this when we were working on the script for detecting whether our YouTube stream at The Incomparable was live, and we were exceeding YouTube's query limit. Because essentially every time anybody hit the page, it would immediately issue a new query. And at that point, you know, it's like, well, if 60 people, even if like 50 or 60 people hit the page, those are 50 or 60 queries. And if they reload the page to check and see if it's live again, that's another 50 or 60. So I ended up having to build a system that cached it for 5 minutes.
Caches the query every 5 minutes, and there's one query and then the page. Yeah, it's just, it's a thing. So Dr. Drang sent me a message and he said, congratulations, you're a programmer, because he's he's big into the scripting is programming. And that, and it was, I honestly, one of the things that I found that was really fascinating this week is that, so the air, and this is more about computers than it is about air quality, so I apologize if this is boring, but it's about computers, so I feel like this is the place to do it. The air quality sensor that I'm querying, it does not actually spit back an AQI number, an air quality index number. It spits back a parts per million particle number. And then you have to translate it. And I was like, well, how do I translate it? So I Google this, and there are a bunch of web calculators where if you put in the parts per million, it will give you the AQI. But it doesn't show you the math. And I'm like, well, where's the math? And I finally found, actually, somebody who had written a PHP script to query this same network and had done, had looked it up and did the math and wrote a function to convert the particle number to an AQI. And I was like, great. But it was in JavaScript, or no, it was in PHP. And I was building my thing in AppleScript. And it was a funny exercise in how the languages are the same and how they're different. Because I basically copied the PHP out, pasted it into my script, and then changed it in very minor ways, and then it ran. It was a, I mean, I dropped in a function. I know, I like, I could, yeah, I could change a few things about it, but essentially, it was just doing math based on variables, and that was pretty easy to do. And then the funny thing is, then you helped me with the PHP version, so I used the actual PHP, and then for the widget, I had to turn it into JavaScript, which I don't know JavaScript at all, but I was able to figure out how to convert it. And so it was fascinating to look at three scripting languages essentially and see how they approach the same problems differently. And honestly, how much of that code was completely just reusable.
I mean, I ran into this issue when I wrote that piece a couple of weeks back about the feels like temperature conversion. I had the same thing, and very nicely there, the NWS actually does provide the formula for, but I had to translate it from, they had just written it in a PDF in like a notation, and I was like, oh, that's not going to work. So I had to like go and like translate it into all the correct operators, how you represent the operators in PHP with all the variable. Actually, it wasn't even PHP. I did it in shortcuts. So it's just like, again, like figuring out like, okay, all these things have like parentheses, you know, X for the times thing. It's like, I got to use an asterisk in the, you know, in the shortcuts instead of X, and then all that, you know, a slash instead of a little divider sign and all that. And so that was a definitely a challenge, but I had a similar issue. I was looking at a weather script, that it, some, a plugin that somebody had written for the Bitbar, and it was having an issue, and it was written in Python. And so I was like, well, I don't know Python. I have looked at Python before, but it's close enough. like with your JavaScript to PHP thing, like, there is enough similarity in how languages are structured, and if you know what a script is supposed to do, that you can sort of, okay, I think I can figure this out. And I fixed one problem, but now it's got a new problem. Like, I don't know if the script is worth the time for me anyways.
If you're missing the context here, by the way, I wrote last week about this at Bitbar, which I've written about before, but I've never written explicitly just an article about Bitbar. I've thrown it into favorite utilities a bunch. Like, I wrote a favorite menu bar thing for Macworld. I threw it in there. We did one of our roundups of favorite apps of the year, and I threw it in there, but I realized I'd never done it. And I'd spent so much time messing around with this music plugin for Anthony Johnston, which I wrote about last week on the site, that I would write about it in the context of telling people about Bitbar. And Bitbar is brilliant because there's nothing to it. It is literally a folder. I mean, the app is very clever, but building things for it is super easy because the app has a plugins folder. And I just made sarcastic air quotes because a plugin, Dr. Drang laughed about that with me too. He was like, yes, plugins are text files that run scripts. But literally, you can put a shell script, PHP script, any executable file on your Mac, and all it does is take the text that's returned when the script fires. And then it's got, Bitbar has a system where you can like make submenus and hyperlinks and colors and all sorts of stuff, but it's as simple a thing as you could possibly imagine. And so what I was going to say is that the script that Anthony wanted was based on a script that was just posted on the Bitbar website that's a little shell script for Apple Music. And I don't know shell scripting very well either, but I was able to modify it and hack around with it. And I think that may be my true talent, my true programming talent, is hacking around existing scripts and learning that way. And then with Anthony's thing, the solution, and I mentioned this in my post last week, the solution was like, oh, well, he wanted the year of the album displayed in the menu bar, because it just will put, Bitbar just puts stuff in the menu bar. It's great. And I realized I had to get that from AppleScript, but that's easy, because in the shell script you can fire off the OSA script command on the Mac, which literally is now run an AppleScript. So
right.
That's what I did, and that was the solution. So
chain it all together.
Yeah. But it's all because that's how that script actually works, is it fires off some Apple script to the music app and says, what are you playing? And then gets back the data and formats it and puts it in the menu bar. And you could do that in anything. The person who wrote it as a shell script, but I've got PHP scripts in there. And I also have not Apple scripts per se, but I have one line Bitbar plugins that just call an Apple script, and then they run the Apple script runs in the, it all's invisible. You would never know. It's fun, though, because, I mean, I like, as a Mac user, customization, right? Like, that's old school Mac users. Like, I want my stuff. I want it to be my Mac, and I want it where I want it. And Bitbar is great because if you have a modicum of scripting skill, you could take literally anything you can find and put it in your menu bar. And that's fun. I love it.
Yeah, no, I enjoy it. It's gotten me back into doing a lot more programming stuff, which I've actually found myself doing more and more of during our quarantine. It's like almost like a hobby I picked up, like, because, you know, I used to do this for a living, but it was 15 years ago at least.
So it's Windows XP time.
Yeah, exactly. And so dusting off some of that and realizing, of course, the language has changed a little bit here and there. There were definitely things that I remembered, and it's like, oh, this changed like five versions ago, and it's like, oh, well, I missed that. But you know, it's so capable, and so much stuff is available on the web these days, that, you know, having a web-based scripting language, I feel like, is huge in terms of the information you can take from one place and sort of massage and present somewhere else, right? Like, and services you can kind of glue together or combine.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it gets much more, and there are services, right, abstracting all of this on the top too, right? Like, if you lose something like IFTTT or Zapier or something, like, they're kind of just providing an interface on top of what is essentially APIs for all of these things. But if you know enough to dig a little deeper and you want to sort of, you know, use the API yourself, there's a lot that you can do that, you know, those services don't let you easily do, right? Because they're optimized for simple tasks that people are going to want to, you know, a lot of people are going to want to do, as opposed to you might have very specific needs that are not covered by those systems.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The great thing about having all these services on the internet is that you can query them, and sometimes there's a cost, and sometimes there's a rate limit. And, you know, the beauty of how Bitbar works is the rate limit, the rate at which the plugin refreshes is just in the file name.
Yeah, I was looking for that yesterday when I realized I had exceeded a API limit, and I was like, there must be a way to do this, right? Like, it can't just be an auto refresh thing, and then it's like, oh yeah, just stick this in the name. I was like, well, that's both dumb and incredibly stupid at the same time.
Yeah,
or smart. Sorry, incredibly smart at the same time. I mean,
it's
sure a combination of like, it's very clever. And it's something I would never have thought to do.
Right. Yeah. So like my air quality script is aq.5m.php. And right. That means exactly. Refresh it every 5 minutes.
Yep. Very simple. Very easy. And that was the best. Like, I like that it's just a simple option rather than having... I started thinking, God, I have to write like a whole nother cache. How do I even do a caching system when it's based on a script that just runs?
Yep. Nope.
And then I realized, oh, no, it's way easier than that.
Yeah. You just put in the file name. It's great.
Yep.
Well... programming. That was something with launching six colors in WordPress that I got to spend all that time with PHP but I have found that like that writing that script the other night, that was just great. That was like balm for my soul to mess around in editorial in iOS beta and make a little widget or adapt a widget where it was like this guy had done a lot of the work and taught me sort of how to write the script, but he hadn't done the calculations and it wasn't formatted the way I want. And I had to look in the documentation and figure out how to format that widget. And in the end, I got more or less exactly what I wanted, which was great. And I learned, the difference between PHP and JavaScript, which was hilarious, which is that PHP
pre-processing and post-processing.
PHP as a language, you've got to have a $ before all your variables, and you've got to have semicolons at the end of everything, literally everything. And JavaScript, you don't have either of those things, but capitalization counts. And although I am really annoyed by semicolons and brackets and all of that, not the dollar signs actually, because I learned programming from basic,
yeah,
and so seeing a dollar sign next to a word, even though in basic it was after the word and in PHP it's before the word, like my brain knows that that's a string, but you know, a variable, but I'm let's how shall I put this, fundamentally default for me, I am incredibly lax about capital letters. When I'm writing for publication, I put on my big boy pants and capitalize things properly. But anyone who spent any time interacting with me in another online context will know I kind of don't capitalize most things. I just don't care. I capitalize like proper nouns and stuff, but like, did that sentence start with a capital letter? Maybe not. I kind of don't care. I don't know why I think the shift key is extra work, but it's extra mental overhead, and sometimes I just don't care. Boy, that is a habit that is immediately terrible in JavaScript. I had no idea. I'm like, oh, it's color.purple with a lowercase color and a capital purple. Nope. Error. I'm like, what do you mean error? I'm like, oh, I guess capital color, lowercase purple? Runs. I'm like, oh god. Yeah. Oh god. Yeah. JavaScript. I mean,
every PHP writer has done the thing where they have opened a script and tried to run it on a page and the whole page is blank and you're like, oh no, there's a missing quote somewhere.
There's clearly a quote or a semicolon gone.
The best is, and this makes a difference, this is kind of like your capitalization thing, because this was what drives me bananas, is that there are cases where you can use either a single quote or quotation marks.
Yes.
And just don't mix
them.
In fact, you can mix them, and sometimes you need to mix them, because if you have a string that contains one of them, you need to use the other one as the thing that contains that string.
But don't start a string with one and end it with the other, because that doesn't work. No,
something will break. Yeah, that will break badly.
Yep, yep, yep. This is all fun stuff. And I know so many of our listeners are programmers, and they're just laughing at these two writers talking about this stuff, but that's the beauty of it. We're like the from the mouths of babes. comments about scripting languages and programming languages. I'll tell you a thing that I actually kind of appreciate about JavaScript, which is I think I like the little dot syntax where you can build up like a whole thing where it's like a subcategory of a subcategory with a function, and you kind of like dot them all together and then it works. And I'm like, wow, that's kind of cool. Because my brain's like, oh, this is going to take 5 steps. And obviously the designer of this language was like, I don't want to take 5 steps. I'm just going to stack everything together, put dots in between it, and it'll be fine. Like, great. Okay. I would never have guessed that. But looking at other person's code, I'm like, oh, I bet this is how you do it. And it totally is. Whereas in PHP, I just had that thing the other day with my weather station thing with a Lemetric time display where I had to do an if statement inside of an if statement. And all of a sudden I spent like, I swear, Dan, I spent 5 minutes staring at curly brackets trying to figure out when does the first if statement end, but the second one continues. And I thought, this is very bad. Like,
that's actually a thing that BBEdit is actually very good at. If you have that on, is like it can. They off a lot of programming tools have the thing where you highlight one bracket and it shows you the matching one.
Yeah. Oh no, I did. I used that a lot actually.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things where I ended up commenting every single if and else statement for my own logic. I was like, okay, this one does this. Now this one does this. I'm like, and then I got to the last one. I'm like, oh, that's why. Because I literally, it was behaving badly, and it was because one curly bracket was in a slightly wrong place. So it was inside of an if statement it should not have been inside of. So
I having used PHP for a long time, my head just understands it.
Yeah.
And I have trouble with it. Like, I can like read a little bit of JavaScript because I did a little bit of work with it, but I just fundamentally don't grok it as much.
Sure.
And I did study Java briefly in school, and Java and JavaScript are not the same remotely. Well,
and people say, why do you still use AppleScript? And you know, my answer is mostly that one is that I know it, and so it's easy. And so why not use the thing that is easy? But there is another reason. I mean, and also part of it is that sometimes if you're dealing with Mac apps on a Mac, you know, you do need to go to AppleScript, just like that shell script for Apple Music. Like, in the end, there's an OSA script command that is embedded AppleScript, because to get data out of an app, you need to talk to it in the language it speaks. And right now, still on the Mac, it speaks Apple events, and AppleScript is the most common way.
Right.
And you could use JavaScript,
but
really, it's like the easiest way to do it is this way. But the other thing I realized is that I have Script Debugger from Late Night Software, which is an IDE basically for AppleScript.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason that I'm so comfortable with AppleScript is that I have this app that's really good, and I don't use a lot of its features. Like, it'll let you put in breakpoints and like step through code, and I have used those in the past, but I rarely ever use them today. But the one thing that it has is you can run an app and see all of the data, all the variables. And since one of the scripts I was doing was parsing JSON from a server, in Script Debugger I can actually go through and find the JSON and then literally find the variable I need to pull out and drag it into the script. And it makes the reference to get to that particular bit of data. Whereas when you and I were talking about PHP, I'm like, Dan, how do I get this item down in the JSON tree? And you're like, And we had to go back and forth, and you had to write a for loop. And that was that moment where I was like, oh, like, this is another reason that I resort to AppleScript a lot of the time, is that I have a tool for AppleScript that lets me like point at a thing and say, how, and instead of being like, how do I access this thing? I literally drag that thing into the editor and it puts the code in of how you access that thing. I'm like, oh yeah, I suppose if I had one of these for PHP or JavaScript or whatever, it would probably make it better than it is in a tool that doesn't have any of those kind of helper pieces.
Yeah, no, I've done PHP dev on both Windows and Mac, and I think I always pretty much just use like a text editor of some variety. Sometimes usually something like BBEdit that has tools that are, you know, well designed to help you, but it's not like a GUI, you know, real thing designed to be an IDE specifically for that language.
Well, the idea that you have a PHP file and you can run it and you can see what all your variables were without like writing things to the console
or something like that.
And then it might actually like let you, like my example is great, which is like, okay, I found this thing. How do I refer to it? If you could like click it and drag it or click it,
yes,
and have it like insert the way that that is in the language referred to. It's like, that is very helpful. And let me tell you, for AppleScript, that is super helpful because AppleScript syntax
is terrible.
It's terrible.
I cannot. No. Every time I look at your scripts, I'm like, oh, I'll figure this out. Like, I'll piece it out, you know, and just, well, and I look at them, and I'm like,
that,
I don't understand
be,
a word.
That may be me, but some of it is
app
has its own scripting dictionary. And what I found, the way I look, quote unquote, learned AppleScript is find a script that works with an app and see how it does what it does, and then use that,
reverse engineer it,
because you can't, by looking at an app, figure out exactly what you need to tell it to do what it needs to do, because if you imagine, every single app essentially has its own dictionary. So scripting app A and scripting app B require entirely different approaches, and it's so frustrating. But if you can find examples, then you can do it, and that's basically why I'm a gleaner, basically. I was going to say a pirate, but it's more like a gleaner, where I'm finding like scripts laying on the ground, and I'm like, oh, this could be useful later, and I put it in my bag.
How I learned to do most stuff in programming.
HTML,
is by dissembling what's there.
Yeah, was the same thing. It's nice. It's actually one of my favorite things about all these scripting languages is that the scripts are open, so you can see how they work, and you can learn from them, and you can take pieces of them and apply them to your problem. And
I love it. Routinely, I find in my experience, any time that I run into an error, someone else has run into that. So like, you gave me like, how come this keeps giving me this error when I run this script? And I was like, yeah, that's weird. And I went and like Googled it, and it's like, oh, there's this change in the language where it's reporting this as a warning. And like, I was like, oh, okay. So either literally this was our fix for that problem in the script was,
don't show the warnings.
Either I could go around this and try to figure out a way to make this like comply, or just tell it not to show any warnings and it works fine.
That's actually a thing that happened to me with the WordPress stuff, where, you know, I'm working with the people at Automattic. They are the experts at WordPress, and they have this whole diligent, like, they have this whole system of like, you need to have your PHP code pass these tests before you submit it to GitHub, or it won't, your pull request will be denied, and all this stuff. I'm like, okay. And I had to learn it, and I had to script some of it, all of this stuff. And then I had this one place where it was like in an HTML template, and I'm like, it's refusing my HTML because the line is too long, but it's an enormous query to a server, and it's the URL. So I can't not have it be there. And they're like, oh. And then they just inserted the ignore all of the rules that we make you follow line.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, well, that's nice. Right? That's super convenient to tell it to ignore your error warnings. And now it validates. Great. Thanks, guys.
Sometimes that's the easiest solution.
Sometimes it is. Well, this has been Tech Talk with programming. Quote unquote programming.
Quote unquote.
Well, who knows what next week will bring, Dan? Who knows?
September. I can tell you that much.
Maybe. We'll see.
Oh yeah. I guess there's still a few days left. It could go either way.
It could. Well, we'll be back, I suppose, next week, right? I mean, what else are we gonna do?
Yeah, I don't know. I'll be here.
All right. Until then. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.